Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, sixth chapter, text 20. Evam yatantam vijnane. Evam yatantam vijnane. Mam maha gocharo giram. Mam maha gocharo giram. Gambira slakshnaya vacha. Gambira slakshnaya vacha. Sucha prasamayam iva. Sucha prasamayan iva. Evam yatattam vijnane. Mam maha gocharo giram. Gambira slakshnaya vacha. Sucha prasamayan iva. Sorry, addiction. Evam yatantam vijnane. Mama ho gocharo giram. Gambira slakshnaya vacha. Vaishnavis. Okay. Evam. Thus. Yatantam, one who is engaged in attempting. Vijane, in that lonely place. Mam, unto me. Aha, said. Agochara, beyond the range of physical sound. Giram, utterances. Gambira, grave. Slakshnaya, pleasing to hear. Vacha, words. Sucha, grief. Prasamayan, mitigating. Eva, like. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Seeing my attempts in that lonely place, the personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to all mundane description, spoke to me with gravity and pleasing words, just to mitigate my grief. So the person speaking here is somebody named Narada Muni. Okay, purport. In the Vedas, it is said that God is beyond the approach of mundane words and intelligence. And yet, by his causeless mercy, one can have suitable senses to hear him or to speak to him. This is the Lord's inconceivable energy. One upon whom his mercy is bestowed can hear him. The Lord was much pleased with Narada Muni, and therefore the necessary strength was invested in him so that he could hear the Lord. It is not, however, possible for others to perceive directly the touch of the Lord during the probationary stage of regulative devotional service. It was a special gift for Narada. When he heard the pleasing words of the Lord, the feelings of separation were to some extent mitigated. A devotee in love with God feels always the pangs of separation and is therefore always enwrapped in transcendental ecstasy. Om Aginatam Ananda Shajananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudevena Maha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam. So, first we'd like to welcome Professor Clooney, or Clooney or Clooney? What's the correct pronunciation? Clooney. Professor Clooney, and the Jesuit novices that have accompanied him. Thank you very much for coming today. It's an honor to have you here. So this is a story about a devotee. He's one of the sort of very most important devotees within our tradition. His name is Narada Muni. And he's one of the great spiritual masters within the tradition. He goes back a long ways. He's one of the sons of Lord Brahma, who is the demigod who's sort of sometimes referred to as the chief engineer of this universe. He's not the real, the actual creator of the universe, of course, is God himself, Krishna. In this tradition, we refer to him as Krishna, name for God. Lord Brahma is kind of like somebody subordinate to him, and he does a lot of work in setting up the universe, and Narada Muni is one of his offspring. So he goes back a long ways. And without getting too technical into too many details, this story is takes place a long time ago, and Narada Muni, in this particular story, was he was in an unusual situation. For some reason, he was born as in a particular part of his life, he was the son of a maidservant. There's a background story to that, which I'm not going to go into. But and then he was, when he was 5 years old, his mother, who was his only shelter, you know, he didn't have his father. There's no mention of his father or other family members. He was living with his mother. She was a maidservant. She was taking care of, she was like working at an inn where some sages used to stay during the rainy season. In India, they have 4 months out of the year, it rains a lot. So the sages who would normally be traveling around, they, during that rainy season, they would just kind of stay put in one place. So she was working at an ashram, actually, you know, where they were staying. And Narada Muni, he was only 5 years old, but he was getting the opportunity to hear them speak and, you know, talk to each other about spiritual subject matters and do service for them, you know, wash their dishes, clean their clothes, whatever a five-year-old boy could do. And he would sometimes eat the remnants of their food like that. So as a result of doing that, though, the sages kind of, they were, you know, affectionate towards him, and they bestowed their blessings upon him during that period. So shortly thereafter, the rainy season finished and they all departed, and he was there with his mother again, just him and his mom at the ashram. And his mother went out to milk a cow, and she got bitten in the leg by a snake, and she died. So Narada Muni is only 5 years old, but he's decided, okay, this is, he took it as a special mercy of the Lord. There's a verse in here earlier in this chapter that says, I took it as a special mercy of the Lord, who always desires benediction for his devotees. And so thinking, I headed north. In other words, he just decided that rather than get all upset, you know, oh, what am I going to do now? I'm just a five-year-old boy. My mother's been bitten by a snake and she's passed away and I'm all on my own. And No, he was already sort of elevated in consciousness to a certain extent by the mercy of those sages and like that. So he just took it as an opportunity. Okay, let me get serious about spiritual life. And what he did was, rather than head for the next village and, you know, try to hook up with some family or something like that, he just headed north to the Himalaya Mountains, to the, you know, to the forest to meditate. He went through towns and villages and, you know, the whole works, and he just, nope, no interest. Didn't, you know, wasn't concerned about his material future. And he went to the forest, and in the forest he was meditating, and actually he was successful. He was successful. He was meditating. He was doing, you know, the form of meditation that's quite popular these days. At least you see people doing it with this. He was doing that, and he actually saw Krishna appear to him within his heart and then externally as well, right? Yeah. So he actually was successful in his meditation, and he saw Krishna, but then his meditation broke. Krishna disappeared. And he thought, oh my, well, wow, I've got to try again. So he, you know, he went into the meditation again, and he made a second attempt and a third attempt and a fourth attempt like that, but not successful. And then finally, this is what happened here. He, as it says here, that brings us up to the present verse. Seeing my attempts in that lonely place, the personality of Godhead, Krishna, who is transcendental to all mundane descriptions, spoke to me with gravity and pleasing words just to mitigate my grief. So he got the mercy in another form. First he got the mercy in that he was able to successfully meditate and see Krishna. And then when his second, third, fourth, etc. attempts failed, Krishna was still observing him. And he was compassionate. He was merciful to him, and he allowed him, Narada Muni, to hear him speak. So actually, Krishna spoke to Narada Muni. He actually heard God speak to him. His spiritual senses were awakened, and he was able to hear God speak to him. So this is the story of somebody who, a young boy, in this particular case, who got very serious about spiritual life, and he actually got that benediction. He got the blessings. He was actually able to both see and hear, see God and hear God speak to him. So it's a pretty amazing sort of a situation. Of course, there's a lesson there for us. I mean, one lesson is that we're supposed to, you know, from these narrations are there, here in these books to inspire us that we should try to follow in the footsteps of these great personalities. Not imitate, and this is an important point, but follow in the footsteps. In other words, just as Narada Muni got very serious about spiritual life, even as a young boy, 5 years old, and in a very difficult situation, and was able to be successful, so in the same way, we should get very serious about spiritual life at whatever stage of life we're in. And, you know, by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, we can also be successful. Not by the same method. This is a method that was meant for that particular age. You know, people of that age when he was living were qualified to do that. We couldn't do that. At least I couldn't do that. If I had to go out to the forest to meditate, I definitely would. I don't think I could last more than 5 minutes. Especially with today's temperature. No, couldn't do it. But so things are adjusted, and the process for spiritual enlightenment has been made very simple in this day and age. Basically, it's what you see us doing here now, you know, coming together and chanting the names of God, and that's one very important aspect of it. Studying these are the scriptures that are coming down through an unbroken chain of enlightened spiritual masters, which goes back to and originates from Krishna or God himself, and other things like that, different items. So that's the process. Now it's something that is doable, but in the same way, if we're serious about that process, like Narada Muni was serious about that his process, then we'll also be successful, and we can also get the mercy of the Lord. So now I studied up a little bit on Jesuits, in preparations for this class, and I'm really actually very happy that you're here, because I think it's something that's I think we have a lot in common. You know, I really think we have a lot in common. I read something here, found something on the internet about the spiritual exercises of Ignatius of Loyola. And it's one point here really caught my attention here. It says here, it's a series of it's meditations, right? Contemplative prayers. Yeah? And it says here they're divided into four thematic weeks of variable length, and they are designed to be carried out over a period of 28 to 30 days. Now here, this is what really caught my attention. They were composed with the intention of helping participants in religious retreats to discern the will of God in their lives, leading to a personal commitment to follow, in this case, Jesus, whatever the cost. So when I read that, I just went, whoa, that's exactly what we're trying to do here. That's what we're trying to do, too. I mean, we're a totally different tradition, obviously, but that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to discern the will of God in our lives. In other words, we're trying to understand, what does God want me to do? He's put me here. Here I am. I mean, you know, I'm here because by God's will, what does he want me to do? What am I supposed to do with my life? Well, I want to do all the right things, and I don't want to do any of the wrong things. And, you know, so this is, apparently that, you know, the Jesuits are feeling the same way. And they want to have that strong personal commitment to follow Jesus, who for them is either God or the Son of God or both or like that. So, yeah, when I read that, I felt like, wow, we really do have a lot in common. And actually, I grew up surrounded by Jesuits. It's a Catholic religious order, right? But not the only one. There are many. Yeah, I grew up surrounded by Catholics. I don't think the Jesuits. Most of the kids in the neighborhood I lived went to either St. Helena's or St. Raymond's. I don't know what order they are. And one of my friends, I won't say best friends, but a close friend that I grew up with, used to play football together. I think he's a Marist brother. And Armand Lamagna. And I actually met up with him about 5 years ago. I went to visit, went for like a reunion back in New York, which is where I'm from, and stayed overnight with him at his, they had a place in kind of midtown Manhattan. And I brought him to the Hare Krishna temple there in Manhattan, and he was quite impressed. He had no idea that we had, I remember he repeated about several times when the temple president took him for a tour of the temple and went to each different picture and explained what what the meaning of the picture, what was going on there, what it was all about. And at least three or four times he said, whoa, I had no idea you had such a comprehensive philosophy. He was impressed. He liked it. So it made me feel good. And yeah. But, as I said, we have a lot in common, more in common than different. I mean, one thing for sure is that people who are, novices, Jesuit novices or any other, I know there's many other denominations. I could remember a few myself from just Franciscans, Dominicans, Carmelites, Cistercians, Benedictines, Augustinians. Those are the ones, I know there's more, but those are the ones that I remembered hearing about. So, we all believe in a supreme being. We all believe that there's an infinitely powerful, not intelligent, and benevolent supreme being that's the ultimate origin of everything, correct? We share that, which is significant, because a lot of people these days are just walking around. I don't know if they're actually thinking, but they're just, by default, they're accepting that the origin of everything is absolutely nothing. That's kind of, a very prominent way of thinking or not thinking, however you want to refer to it. But we don't subscribe to that the absolute origin of everything, and the origin of everything is absolutely nothing. I mean, I don't think, and then it became something, and then that something became everything that we're experiencing today. I don't think that can be proven. I know it can't be proven. And practically speaking, what good would that do you anyway? I mean, say if you prayed to absolutely nothing, you dedicated your life and prayed to absolutely nothing, what possible benefit could you derive from absolutely nothing? I'm being a little sarcastic here. It doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to do that? You know, absolutely, it's a dead end. But if you dedicate your life to an infinitely powerful, knowledgeable, and benevolent supreme being and pray to him for his mercy, you get a lot of benefit from that. I mean, a lot of good things can happen in your life as a result of that, on a material level, on a spiritual level, on many different levels like that. So it makes a lot more sense. Anyway, so what's happening in this verse here is, as I mentioned, this person, Narada Muni, he's becoming enlightened, spiritually enlightened by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's pleased with his efforts like that. And he's able to, it's mentioned here in the purport that he, one can have suitable senses to hear him, referring to him in with a capital H, or speak to him. It's referring to the Supreme Lord. One upon whom his mercy is bestowed can hear him. Basically, the idea here is that we're all essentially, well, this is our theology anyway, we're all essentially spiritual beings. And we have material senses, but the material senses are based upon spiritual senses. We're actually experiencing the material world now because our spiritual senses are asleep. You know, our spiritual senses are the same senses, but it's just like when somebody's asleep. They're dreaming, okay? And they're basically like in another world. You know, they might be having a good dream, they might be having a bad dream, but it's just, it's all, in one sense, like an illusion. It's an experience, but it's a less important experience than, say, being awake. So in the same way, we're alive now. I mean, you know, if this is what we're experiencing right now, it's real, but, you know, it's not, the analogy is, what we're experiencing now is to our real life, our spiritual life, which our relationship to Krishna, God, as what a dream is to being awake. It's different. You know, when you're dreaming, it's real, it's an experience, right? But it's low grade. You know, it's like low quality. And then when you wake up, everything makes more sense. You know, it's like the whole, I'd much rather be awake than asleep, even if I was having a good dream. You know, so in the same way, when you become spiritually elevated by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, when you actually purify your consciousness, is the expression that we use a lot, you know. When you purify your consciousness of all material contamination, I hope that doesn't sound too much like jargon to you, but when we purify our consciousness of material contamination, then our spiritual consciousness is right there. It's not something that you got to get from someplace else. It's already there, and it just has to be awakened. Just like a person who's sleeping, you don't have to give them an injection of of waking reality. You just got to wake them up. You know, the potential for being a normal ordinary person in the world is there. You just have to wake them up, and then there it is. So they can. They'll function like a normal, ordinary person. So in the same way, the potential for us to be, to function on the spiritual platform, it's already there. There's a nice verse in one of our scriptures. It goes, I'll say the Sanskrit even, it goes, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sabu Kabe Naya Shravanade Sudachite Koryu Dadat. Pure love for Krishna or God is lying dormant within the heart of every living being. Every living being. Shravanade sudachite kore udai. It's awakened by this, what we're doing, with this process of hearing about Krishna, chanting his God's holy names like that, and other things. It's awakened. See, so it's not something that has to be invented or created, just awakened. So that's what is happening here. Narada Muni had his pure love, partially, had his dormant Krishna consciousness awakened by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And we can also, and that's what actually this movement, that's what it's all about. This is a movement to help people revive their awareness of their original nature, which is completely spiritual, and understand and actually experience what their eternal relationship is with God. That's what this Krishna consciousness movement is all about. And I think that probably is kind of, well, I really don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's very similar to something that, you know, a goal of Catholic monks like that. It is. Great. So, yeah, that's what's happening here. The details probably, you know, I imagine vary from one tradition to another. The things that we focus on here is, as I mentioned, we do the chanting. And also, we offer all our food. We're vegetarians, and we eat vegetarian food, but that it doesn't stop there, because we believe that God's a person. We have a personal relationship with him. So as part of the process for reviving our awareness of that relationship, we offer our food in like a devotional offering to Krishna, to God. And if it's done nicely, you know, if it's done according in the proper way, the understanding is that Krishna accepts that. He accepts that devotional, the food that's offered in that devotional way, and it becomes transformed. I mean, it's still, you know, an apple would still look like an apple, but it takes on a spiritual quality. So the idea is that when you eat that food that's been offered to Krishna, it's like blessed food. And by eating that, you also purify your consciousness. So the chanting is there and to help us purify our consciousness. Eating blessed food is another part of the process. And this might sound like, well, you know, that sounds like pretty simple. It is pretty simple. But there's a reason why it's that simple, because it's explained in our scriptures that the age we're living in now is actually a very degraded age. And if the process for spiritual realization if it was very difficult, like what it was for Narada Muni, nobody would be able to do it. See, just like Professor Clooney, was it? Okay, so just like he's your professor, he's giving the course, so he sets the course requirements. If he made the course requirement for you guys to pass your course, that you had to get publish a book that had to be a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, you wouldn't be able to pass. You know, so he doesn't set it that he makes it so that you can, you got to write a paper, you got to pass a final exam, you got to hand in your homework, whatever, you know, something that's achievable. So in the same way, Krishna does the same thing. He's setting the bar where people are going to be able to clear it. You know, he knows where people in this age are. This is in our tradition, it's referred to as the age of Kali, which means the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. So Krishna knows what people are capable of, and he's given us a process that we could do successfully, and that is chanting and taking spiritual food, studying this philosophy, and avoiding certain very materialistic activities. For instance, when somebody takes initiation, I think as novices you probably at some point take an initiation, right? Okay, so we have that too. We have initiation. So at the time of initiation, Hare Krishna novices make four promises. One is no illicit sex, which means no sex life except for if you're married, and ideally when you're trying to have children. Okay, that's one. No eating meat, fish, or eggs. No gambling. And thank you. I'm forgetting. No intoxication. No, we don't even, use any coffee, tea, like anything with intoxicants and like that. So we avoid those things. Why? Because they, those activities help, tend to cause you to identify more with your body. They put you more in what we refer to as the bodily concept. They make you more bodily conscious. We're trying to away from that. It's just like if you try to light a fire, you don't want to pour water on it at the same time. So if you're trying to ignite your spiritual consciousness, you don't want to engage in the activities which are kind of, you know, enhancing or causing you to have more material consciousness. Right? Makes sense, right? So at the time of initiation, we promise to follow those four rules and regulations, and we also promise that we're going to chant the names of God a certain fixed number of times every day. We actually use something very similar to a rosary. Do Jesuits use rosary beads? Okay. We have we call them japa beads. And there's 108 beads, and basically we chant one prayer on each bead, and we move on to the next bead. And, you know, we chant those 108 beads 16 times, 16 times around those beads, and it takes about 2 hours plus or minus, and we do that every day. Those are the vows that somebody takes at the time of initiation. So, as I said, I'm sure you probably, I don't know what your vows are, but it varies in the detail, but it's interesting. The principle is the same. You know, you take vows to dedicate yourself for that purpose of being able to discern what is the will of God in our lives and follow it. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions? Sure. Oh, I'll try. So being nonviolent is a religious principle, so it's an important religious principle. But the origin of all religious principles is God Himself. See? So if God Himself, you know, the origin of all religious principles, right, is thinking that what needs to be done in this situation is we need to be violent here, then that's the topmost religious principle. See? So Krishna is, in Bhagavad Gita, is Krishna's Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna, in his infinite wisdom, decided that was the best course of action in that particular situation. We need to have some violence here. These members of the other party are wholly and solely corrupt, and they haven't responded to any and all attempts to make a peaceful settlement, which many were attempted. And therefore, the only thing left to do is you're going to have to fight with them. And I know that's going to be, you know, these Christians talking to John, I know it's going to be difficult for you to do because, you know, the family members, there's a family relationship there of some sort, but that's what's got to be done. That's it. So that's it. The highest religious principle is to, as it says here, discern the will of God in our lives and follow it. And that's what Arjuna had to do, and he did it, fortunately. He was able to successfully do that. Do any of our guests? Oh, Archita Prabhu. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. That was a very good question, but you have to understand, you have to start from the premise that he gave in the beginning that the soul is eternal. So you can't really kill somebody. Nobody actually dies. They're changing their bodies, which happens anyway. Even if Arjuna did not kill those people on the battlefield, they would die anyway. So you're not avoiding their death. But when you kill them because of their aggression, you benefit because you're following God's will, and they benefit because they get a new situation that's better than the one they're in. Either they go back to the spiritual world, or they take birth in a higher place in the material world. So their death becomes not just anonymous and degrading. If they were not killed in that situation, they would all die anyway, and they would go to lower hellish conditions because of their hellish mentality. But when they're killed on God's order, they get elevated.
Hey, do any of our guests have any questions, or even, you know, just any observation you'd like to share with us or comment or yeah, Professor.
You mentioned about what about Gita, so the Society of Jesus and Jesuits at the beginning when we're young and then we do it later more formally, take three vows and sometimes four. So the vow of poverty is that everything we own nothing personally.
We're not monks in the monastery, but we live in the world and we travel, we do work and so on. So we need things, even credit cards and so on. But we have nothing personal. We don't accumulate money. My salary as a professor doesn't come to me, it goes to the order. So we have this poverty, everything belongs in common, nothing personally. Then chastity, we're a celibate order. So certainly the principle of chastity for all Christians, as you said, licit sex within marriage for the sake of family and so on. But we have this vow of total chastity, so a celibate life, brahmacharya, I suppose, of giving all our affections and love to God and then to the community in the non-sexual fashion or not directly sexual. And then obedience, the sense that it is not our will but the will of God that guides our lives, mediated through the superiors of the order, the heads of the order, who can tell us, do this, go there, take this job up, drop that job, and so on. Obedience, not my will, but the will of God through the order. And then some, at a more advanced stage, and this has to do with the history of the order, that the Pope in Rome can ask the Jesuits to take up any mission anywhere in the world. And that if something is needed, even if it's inconvenient, the Jesuits in the United States might go to India, Jesuits in India might go to Africa and so on, just to be mobile, doing the work of God as best we can. So those are the vows we take.
That's like a further development of that last one, obedience, like total self-surrender or something. Yeah, thank you. I actually had those written down, but I'm glad I didn't mention them because you did a much better job of explaining them than I would have. Thank you. Yeah, that's very interesting. It's so similar. It's amazing. Well, it's not amazing, but it's really very similar. Any of the novices had any kind of observations or anything they'd like to ask? Okay, yeah. Well, okay, so we could stop there. Thank you very much. Gandharva Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Keep this here, thank you.
Thank you, Francis. You need a hand up? You all right? Better shape than I am.
Still need work.
Yeah, yesterday I had a special ceremony again for my mother's departure.
Yeah.
And cleaning up afterwards, I picked up a stack of chairs and I pulled something here. So I'm moving a little slowly.
In Krishna consciousness?
Yeah, there's a name.
Oh, Shakyavesh Avatar. Shakyavesh Avatar?
No, it's a different one.
I heard
his name before.
Nope. Cristo? I don't know.
I still have trouble with it showing
forth. Well, it's a hard one.
It's not
Yeshua. Oh, I'm not sure.
There's another name for him, so it's called, but I forget what it is.
How did I do?
Such a lucid, clear discourse. I'm from New York City, too. I'm from Brooklyn.
Okay.
You were near St. Raymond's, I think?
Yeah, I